The other major drug problem in Maine, stimulant misuse. The challenges of substance use disorder often focus on opioids, but another category of drugs is causing widespread problems. Stimulant use is on the rise. This category includes illegal drugs such as cocaine and methamphetamine, but also medicines prescribed legally for ADHD such as Ritalin and Adderall. Public health and recovery experts are increasingly alarmed by the trend. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we discuss the dangers of stimulant use, how prevalent these drugs are in Maine, and what's being done for prevention, treatment, and recovery. And we'll hear from people who are in recovery about their journeys. They will share their stories and advice. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We hear a lot about the opioid crisis in Maine, but another category of drugs is a serious problem as well. Psychostimulants, including cocaine, methamphetamines, and the various medications used to treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Here to learn about these drugs and what's being done to prevent use, Rebecca Ireland, Program Coordinator at the Center for Excellence in Health Innovation at the University of New England, and Dr. Ronald Springall, who's a physician consultant and executive director of the Maine Association of Recovery Residences. We invite your comments and questions. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling. Post a comment to our Facebook page or now to Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you both for being here. Dr. Springall, I'll start with you. You know, we have heard so much about opioid use in the past few years in Maine and the overdose deaths. Tell us about stimulants as a category of drugs. What effects do they have on people? What do we know about how dangerous they are?
Thanks, Jennifer, and great to be here, especially with Becky, who has great expertise in the prevention area. We've known for a long time that psychostimulants, the kinds of drugs that you mentioned, methamphetamine and cocaine and a number of prescription medicines, can have profound effects on human beings. The word stimulants means they stimulate a person's system, their physiology. Pulse is increased, heart rate is increased, blood pressure, breathing, almost all the elements that you can think of in terms of an excitability, they're closely related to adrenaline. So, you know, we know that adrenaline is an important chemical in our bodies. It helps us to decide whether we're going to flee or fight, and they help us to fight. They give us great energy. Well, stimulants were designed really for over 100 years ago in Europe, and they were used to keep fighter pilots awake for longer periods of time, to be given to soldiers so they could fight longer periods of time. And then in peacetime, they were used, for example, to students to help study, increase wakefulness, for truck drivers to be able to be more productive. But the problem with these stimulants is that there's a very short-term effect, a short-term gain, which can be beneficial, but after prolonged use and continued use, the medicines become very destructive on the human body. They can cause all sorts of psychiatric as well as physical disorders. So we developed the term psychostimulant use disorder to talk about this condition, a chronic relapsing disorder, really characterized by compulsive drug taking, compulsive use of these substances, and drug seeking, trying to find these medicines or substances at the exclusion of all other important life activities.
And Dr. Springall, what do we know about statistics in Maine? Do we have a sense of how many people are misusing stimulants and how deadly they have been?
Well, you know, we talk about overdose deaths, and of course we had 504 overdose fatalities last year, which is a horrible number, unfortunately not better this year. And if we look at the trends involving methamphetamine and cocaine, we see that since 2014, we have had remarkable increases, sadly remarkable increases. In the case of cocaine, 460% increase in deaths involving cocaine from 2014 to 2019. And methamphetamine went from one involved death in 2014 to 47 involving 2019. I don't know how many thousands of percent that is, but it's a huge number. So we're seeing this. These statistics come from the state medical examiner's office and then in other surveys and things that we do. For example, we survey high school students. And in the last year that we have statistics available in Maine, Mainers aged 18 to 25 had an 8% use of cocaine in the previous year, whereas the national average is only 6%. So we're seeing that in that young age group, we're seeing significant increases. In 2019, 4% of high school students reported ever using cocaine and 3% ever using methamphetamine, which are higher numbers than in previous years as well.
Becky Ireland, I know you're focused on prevention. I want to sort of come through the back door, though, to prevent this use. You need to understand why people are using. What do we know about why people are using stimulants? It sounds like these numbers are even before the pandemic.
Yes, as Dr. Springle said, we have a variety of drugs that are in this class, and the reasons people start using them can be varied. One thing we know about stimulant misuse, as with any substance misuse, is people have a variety of reasons they use. And for stimulant misuse, we have everything from very high achieving, stressed out teenagers who are trying to perform in the classroom as well as on the athletic field. We've got family people and workers who are trying to balance work and life outside of work, and there just aren't enough hours in the day, or they're trying to work really long shifts, so they may start with misusing stimulants. And they may start with the prescription stimulant misuse and then progress towards other stimulant use as well. So no one is immune to this misuse. It has no one gender, one socioeconomic class. Anyone can do it. There's a variety of pathways. But one thing we do know is that dealing with the stressors of life is a primary reason people start using and misusing stimulants.
I'm sure we could talk for hours about various prevention measures. But what are you focusing on, and what seems to be having an impact in a positive way?
Our initiative is funded by the Maine CDC, and we work with communities across the state to try to look at schools, law enforcement, employers, caring adults, and what everyone can do to reduce access to these stimulants that people may gain access to and feed or start misusing and end up with a substance use disorder. So things like safely disposing of unneeded or unwanted medications, securing any stimulants you might have in your home, car, or workplace, as well as looking at the risk and protective factors that drive young people as well as adults towards misuse, so that we can make sure people have more protective factors that are going to deter misuse and fewer risk factors that may motivate or drive them towards using a stimulant to try to reach some kind of goal.
Calling in now is Sybil Mazarol, who is a Substance Use Disorder Program Manager with the Office of Behavioral Health at Maine's Department of Health and Human Services. Thanks for calling in, Sybil.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I understand there is a brand new text message system in place in Maine to help address drug overdoses. Explain how that came about and how it works.
Well, we had started implementing a real-time data collection program called ODMAP. ODMAP is a program put on by Washington Baltimore HIDA, which stands for High Intensity Drug Trafficking Areas. And Maine started implementing this program out to law enforcement starting in 2019. And one of the things that we really wanted to do, since we were asking them to send us this information that they are, inputting into the system, we wanted to make it a helpful tool, not just to our law enforcement partners, but also to folks out in the community that need help getting access for themselves or on behalf of family members, to treatment, recovery, and harm reduction services.
So how does it work? Who can sign up for this text, and what will it tell them?
Anyone in the community can sign up, and they will ask whether you're a family member or a medical provider, et cetera, you just text Spike to the number that they provided, and anyone can sign up. What will happen is if there is a spike, which is considered 3 overdoses within a 24-hour period in any given county, then, you know, that spike alert message will be sent out via text. What it does is lets individuals know that there's an increase in overdoses in their region, and it will help get them to the knowyouroptions.me website, where they have access to information on getting naloxone kits or accessing one of the substance use clinicians that we have at this point, the options liaisons. So if they need some help navigating the treatment system, they can access or send an email to the options liaisons via that website.
So, and also if there's been a surge in an area, people will find out about that and be warned.
Exactly. Then they can have naloxone on hand, which is really important in, you know, keeping their loved ones alive.
Great. And Sybil, how does one sign up for this?
So you just text the word spike to the number that they've provided, which I believe is 9-OD-NO. And at that point, they will be prompted to fill out their contact information and where they live. Or, you know, we need to understand which county that they reside in so that we can send them out accurate alerts. And once they've signed up, that's it. And when a spike occurs or something happens in their county, they will be able to receive that text message.
Great. And we'll be sure to post more information about this on the Maine Calling Facebook page and the Maine Calling webpage. So thank you so much, Sybil Mazerol, calling in with the Office of Behavioral Health at Maine DHHS. Calling in now is Seth Davis, who is a visiting professor in the Department of Psychology at Husson University. Dr. Davis, thanks so much for calling in. Tell us more about how your work has taught you about how these drugs affect the brain and how stimulants cause addiction.
Sure, thank you. I'm really happy to be here. So one thing that I think is kind of interesting when we talk about things like methamphetamines and MDMA, which is also known as ecstasy, is sort of what they do in the brain. So I find it's actually a very interesting effect. They really do two things. They cause the cells in the brain, which are called neurons, to become leaky and essentially leak or expel their available stores of certain types of neurotransmitters. And the other thing that they do is they also prevent these cells from being able to reabsorb these neurotransmitters, which are the chemical messengers that sort of facilitate communication between neurons. And methamphetamines and MDMA also target certain types of neurotransmitters, particularly dopamine. So dopamine is often known as the reward or the pleasure neurotransmitter. So whenever you experience euphoria, be it from getting high off of a drug or even potentially like eating a really satisfying meal, you're having dopamine release in certain parts of the brain. But they also influence the neurotransmitter known as norepinephrine. Sometimes this is called adrenaline. So anybody who's had like an adrenaline rush sort of knows what the physical response is here. And so you'll see things like the increased heart rate and increased blood pressure and what have you. So it's really the action of these drugs at the cellular level inside the brain that produce the effects that we see.
You know, you're teaching at Husson University, so you're working with college kids. My understanding, Professor Davis, is that for college kids, not necessarily the meth that is on TV made in labs, but the overuse of otherwise prescription drugs such as Ritalin and Adderall is very widespread, and that college students don't seem to think it's that big of a deal.
Yeah, so Ritalin is very similar in what we call its mechanism of action to things like amphetamines. It's definitely not as powerful by any means. But yeah, there is this tendency or this trend, I guess, that we're seeing that students will misuse these drugs in order to, you know, maintain focus for longer periods of time, and you know, hopefully do better on schoolwork and things like that. So there definitely is a misuse component that comes into play.
Thank you so much for calling in. Seth Davis, visiting professor in the Department of Psychology at Husson University. And Becky, I want to turn to you and ask you about this because you do so much prevention work. Do you find that young people are kind of nonchalant about stimulant use?
I think young people, as well as our society in general, are nonchalant about it. We don't know a whole lot about it in terms compared to things like opioids or alcohol. But one of the things that they is a risk factor for misuse is if they don't understand the harm that could come from it. And so in many cases, either they personally or a friend has been prescribed a stimulant or has casually used a stimulant, they've seen some short-term benefits to it, or they're told that it might help them focus more in the classroom or something like that. And so then what they don't understand is that all the things that both the doctor and the last caller mentioned is that it can over time really harm your brain and your body, and it can start to interfere with your goals, your aspirations, and your relationships as patterns of misuse happen. And you start to have strains in your relationship. You're finding that you're maybe seeming more alert, but the quality of your ability to study, the quality of your ability to focus on work or family may actually be diminished. And so they anticipate benefits that may never actually be realized. But unfortunately, at that point, their body has some level of addiction to the substance, where they then need to continue to take it to not feel physically or mentally ill.
Dr. Springer, how much go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to build quickly on what Becky was saying. A lot of parents often ask me, you know, what can we do? We have students in high school. What can we do to reduce the risk that our children are facing? And in a study done in Maine of Maine students in October 2020, they found that clear rules at home when it comes to alcohol and drugs, parental monitoring, and providing stable housing are three factors that can contribute one way or another to the likelihood that your student may become involved with this sort of thing.
So when you talk about clear rules at home, give us some guidelines. What are realistic rules for, say, a senior in high school that are clear rules that actually don't sound like your parents are living on another planet?
Well, you know, today we have generations now of, for example, marijuana use. We have parents that used when they were that age and went through some difficulties and sometimes not, didn't have significant consequences. But we think that being really honest with students about what constitutes experimentation versus anything beyond that, that can be important. Obviously, you know, the safety risks involved with operating vehicles, the information about the brain not really being completely developed until age 26, that they can put their future at risk, understanding things about neuroplasticity, for example, that the younger brains are much more susceptible to that sort of thing. So clear rules with that kind of information. Stable housing is very important. Students without stable housing in the past 30 days were 13 times as likely to use cocaine, 9 times more likely to use meth. So stable housing doesn't mean homelessness. It just means, like, say, for example, a student being between two parents who share custody and things of that sort. So, so parents can educate themselves and educate their children both together and have better outcomes.
Well, Dr. Springer, we do need to go to a break. When we come back, I'm going to ask both of you where people can turn for more information if they want to, especially parents, learn more about the kind of guidance that you're giving. Also, a note, and thank you, Dr. Springer, for this, to register for the Spike text program, text the word Spike to this number, 855-963-5669. Again, 855-963-5669. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Patriot Subaru, with a mission to serve customers, families, community, and each other. Learn more at patriotsubaru.com. And Penobscot Financial Advisors, Maine-based fiduciaries operating from at least 6 feet away. PenobscotAdvisors.com.
I am really not trying to confuse anybody here, but we are going to do another take on inflation.
If we got to a point where wages were pushing up inflation, even moderately, that's a good thing.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will talk about why that is. We'll also have the rest of the day's business news, the numbers from Wall Street, of course, next time on Marketplace.
Join us this evening at 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public is pleased to be a media sponsor of this year's Schoodic Arts Festival. The festival, held at venues throughout the Schoodic Peninsula, is taking place from August 2nd to the 13th and offers a wide variety of workshops for artists and makers. The festival also includes daily performances ranging from folk, blues, and funk to dance and theater. For more details on the Schoodic Arts Festival, please visit mainepublic.org and click on Events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are talking about the misuse of stimulants. My guest, Dr. Ron Springle, who is Executive Director at the Maine Association of Recovery Residences, and Becky Ireland, a Program Coordinator at the University of New England's Center for Excellence in Health Innovation. You can share your comments and questions via a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Joining us on the line now is Patrick H. from Ellsworth, who was addicted to drugs for many years and is now in recovery and helping others at Restoration House. Thanks so much for calling in, Patrick. And tell us a little bit about your story. How is it that you got involved in drug use and stimulant use specifically?
Oh, geez. So at age 11, I was introduced to crystal methamphetamine, crystal meth. And, you know, at that time, I was using angel dust. I grew up in the inner city of Philadelphia. And drugs and alcohol and that lifestyle have been a part of my life for as long as I could remember, whether it was through family or my environment. My drug use kind of took off probably about age 18, and started to experiment with a lot of heavier drugs. And past 10 years, I've struggled pretty hard with methamphetamine use. So, I mean, there's a whole lot in between there, you know, a lot of issues that happened before I picked drugs up. And so, yeah, it's been a long road, and things are looking up now. And, yeah, so.
How long have you been clean, Patrick?
Right. Well, I moved to Machias, Maine. I went through Arise Ministries and, was able to stay clean for 2 years. I was involved in the ministry there, had a little backstep, but I've been here for a few months and, just back on track. Yeah.
Well, congratulations to you. And I do understand that that is very common to have a little bit of, you know, have some bumps in the road to recovery, but that's to be expected and not to be too hard on yourself, right?
Exactly, exactly. Forgiving yourself would be probably the first most important thing. And the hard part is the damage that it leaves in the family and everything around you. We often think that we're doing it to ourselves and we're not hurting anyone when, you know, basically the whole family dynamic kind of deteriorates and causes a lot of issues with people that never use drugs in your family. So
let me ask you this. You said that really for the past decade, it's been methamphetamine that has been the most difficult for you to kick. What is it about meth that makes it so hard compared to even other drugs that are hard to get clean from?
Well, I'm not really sure, like chemically. Well, I've heard stories that as far as the damage that it does to your brain and how it just basically hijacks your brain. I can't say for sure. I mean, I was a heroin addict for years, and when I finally came in contact with methamphetamine, it was just like a high that I never experienced before. And it kind of took the place of the heroin, and I haven't gone back to the heroin since I've used the crystal meth. It's kind of taken the place for all those drugs I've ever done, you know? And you know, it's a tough question. Why I go back? I can tell you why I would go back, and I had mentioned this yesterday to the doc. My daily maintenance, if I don't continue my daily maintenance, the things I'm supposed to do day by day, I'll return to anything, whether it was crystal meth or cocaine or, you know. But I can tell you this, before every relapse, there was a choice, and I made the choice to pick up. I do remember having that. I believe it was the Lord telling me, hey, I'm giving you a way out here, and I chose to pick the drug up. So I can't blame it on the drug.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. I know there are people listening right now, Patrick, who have a loved one they're worried about, perhaps a child or a sibling. Yeah. What is your advice to parents or to siblings? How to talk to the person who is struggling with an addiction, how to talk to them effectively and kindly in a way that won't have that person pushing them away?
Right. It's a great question. So I can tell you personal experience. I remember being in and out and just driving my family through a wall, like splitting my family right down the middle. And I can tell you now that when I started to grow the most is when I was given an ultimatum. And it's so hard to tell a parent, hey, you need to tell your child to leave, or your adult living in the house, hey, you have to leave and they're going to be out on the street. Essentially, we're killing people by letting them stay in our home, stay in the basement, enabling them. Now, barriers have to be set, and they need to follow through with that. You know, like, you can never tell a parent, hey, you're guilty of loving your child, you know, but essentially it killed me. It killed me. And I started to grow when I remember I approached my door one day and it was locked. And my brother was on the other side of the door. And he said, you know, mom, you know, called and said, I can't let you in. And so I was forced to change. And that's a huge thing. So barriers, you know, I heard you guys talking a little bit about the family dynamic, like get involved in your loved one's life. Sit at the family table. We don't sit at family tables anymore. You know, we don't eat dinner together anymore in today's world. So that's an important part, you know.
Well, Patrick, I'm so grateful to you for calling in and sharing your story here on Maine Calling. And we wish you just the best of luck. Congratulations on how far you've come so far. And boy, thank you so much for calling in. Patrick is from Ellsworth, and he is with Restoration House. On the line with us now is Kristen N., who is a nurse practitioner in long-term recovery from prescription psychostimulant use disorder. Hi, Kristen, and thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
You work as a highly trained medical professional. Is that how you got involved with using prescription drugs?
You know, it's not initially how I got involved, although when I share a little bit of my story, you'll see sort of where it took me professionally and whatnot. But I actually started in my younger years, like around age 20. It was sort of the classic, like we've heard the folks earlier speaking about the college sort of epidemic with prescription drugs like Adderall. I took it sort of recreationally in the beginning, and I wouldn't say people were going around saying, oh, this is going to help you study better, but actually there's a component to, in college, sort of the party scene where if you took Adderall, it actually was sort of supposed to be sort of a fun thing. I think then what happens is people wake up Monday morning realizing they need to study and be productive. And I think it kind of perpetuates itself. And it was absolutely mainstay, truly, in the college scene, where people would take it both recreationally, you know, sort of out drinking or partying in that scene, and also to study. And that's sort of where it started for me. And then as my body became more dependent on it, I always like to say it, like, you know, Adderall hijacked my limbic system. It made it seem that it was more important than food, water, relationships. And so my body truly was dependent on it. If I didn't have it, I would actually sort of just fall asleep. My body would just crash. And that was very frightening to me. I thought I was in this cycle of, oh my gosh, if I don't have it, I'm going to crash and then I won't be productive at all.
And how are you able to stop and get help?
So basically for me, what ended up happening is years went by. I did get a prescription for it. And that's the other component I think that's worth mentioning is that a lot of providers will readily give it. In fact, it's absolutely, you know, overprescribed in my opinion. And so it depends on who you get, but they'll prescribe it for you. And you sort of have this, for me, I thought it actually wasn't a problem. I thought if a doctor prescribed it, then therefore it was okay. And I think that's a larger societal thing where we just give ourselves permission. But as we've seen with like opioids, that actually isn't necessarily true anymore. And I think we can apply the same sort of rules to amphetamines. So for me, what ended up happening was I was very successful on the outside and I did, you know, go to nursing school and succeed. And then as I got into my profession, I made really bad choices where my addiction essentially almost halted my career. And so at that point, being in the healthcare field, I needed to make a decision. Am I going to ruin my life completely or am I going to go get help? And I went into treatment for about 4 months and got all the help. I addressed all the issues there that I needed to and went on to have a very productive career, went back to school, went to grad school and became a nurse practitioner. So it's a good happy ending, but it took about 10 years to get there.
Well, congratulations. And I understand you're a decade sober now.
Yes. Yep.
Wow. What advice do you have for others who are either fighting addiction or have loved ones who need help?
Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest question I get, and I do lots of college speaking and among healthcare professionals as well, a lot of people come up and say, am I going to end up like you? Like, I don't want to be addicted. I think the biggest thing is sort of this awareness that that it is something like this particular drug actually can cause you to become very dependent. It's on the black box warning, but we just look past it. So I think there needs to be more by way of prevention. But I think for me, what really helped was when family and friends sort of looked at me and said, look, they started kind of pushing away. And I realized I felt very alone in that. And it was very sad to me. And I think to the point of the previous caller is that sort of tough love and not enabling is what ultimately kind of got me to realize I'm the only person that can take responsibility for what I need to do. And you have to be ready to do that. No one can force you. And I know that's tough for some
folks. I was going to say, that's probably a really hard thing for a lot of loved ones to hear. Well, Kristen, I so appreciate you calling in. Kristen N., a nurse practitioner in long-term recovery. And I really appreciate you telling the story. And this, Dr. Springle, goes back to what you said at the beginning of the program, that there is no one type of person. We've just heard from Patrick and Kristen, both very different backgrounds, both struggling with the same addiction.
Yeah, you know, clearly drug addiction in general is an equal opportunity illness, and it cuts across all socioeconomic barriers, classes, education, doesn't matter how much money you make or how many degrees you have.
And at the beginning of this segment, I meant to talk about some of the resources available. So let's quickly do that now before we go to another break. Dr. Springle, for parents, there is a helpline.
Yes, there's a national drug hotline, which I do have that number for you. National Parent Helpline, 855-427-2736. Also, 211 Maine has a special program for referrals for persons who call with a terrific directory of Maine resources. And I think we'd be remiss, Jennifer, in this program if we didn't mention nicotine, because nicotine actually kills more people than all these other stimulants put together. It just is longer, it takes longer. It's a slow, deadly drug as opposed to the other ones, which act more rapidly. Maine CDC offers a number of resources. You can dial, I think it's just QuitLink, 1-800-QUIT-LINK. I have to check that. If you Google QuitLink, you will find the resources in Maine. Whether you're on Maine Care or not, whether you have private insurance, you can get the information you need to help you quit nicotine.
All right. And Becky, you have a couple websites to mention. All of this, of course, we'll put on the Maine Calling webpage as well. Tell us about your resources you'd recommend.
Yeah, so the state of Maine has developed a website called eyesopenforme.org. That is a great website that cuts across prevention, treatment, intervention, and recovery information and resources to really, for people who are using or the people in their lives who want information about what they can do to provide someone with support, how they can help someone who is in trouble with substance use or to help prevent it. And then our prevention partners across the state are represented on a website called urprevention.org. It's a place people can go to find their local prevention partners, as well as information about what parents, teens, any caring adult can do to help try to get ahead of this, so that hopefully in Maine, we cannot wait until people need treatment or they need to be brought back from an overdose, that we can try to get ahead of this at younger ages or earlier when substance misuse ideas and patterns are just establishing. And so UR Prevention has a whole host of things about what any person can do in their life on a regular basis, from securing and disposing of unneeded medications to how to talk to people they care about coping skills and things they can do to deal with stressors before they turn to substances to try to help them get through life and its challenges, all the way through to how to intervene and talk with someone that you're concerned may be starting to misuse substances and have it impact their life or their relationships.
Well, we do need to take another break. Your comments and questions when we come back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Real Maine, a program of the Maine Bureau of Agriculture, featuring Maine-grown and made agricultural products. Learn more at realmaine.com. And Thomas College, offering graduate programs with flexible learning options for advancing your career. Learn more at thomas.edu/GPS.
I'm Robin Young. With only 1% of Africans vaccinated, the pandemic is raging there, taking lives of the infected, but also those who can't get care as hospitals focus on COVID.
The ripple effect is huge. So where does the woman that's 8.5 months pregnant go? And where does the malnourished child go to be weighed?
We touch down in Zambia next time, Here and Now.
Here and Now, coming up shortly from 12 noon until 2 o'clock after Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. Join us as we explore Maine this summer. Maine Public Summer Breeze Selfie Challenge is designed to help guide you to fun spots throughout vacation land. We've placed Summer Breeze signs from Wells to Presque Isle. Simply take a selfie in front of a Summer Breeze sign, post it to social media using the hashtag SummerBreezeME, and you'll be entered into a drawing to win some great summer prizes. Visit MainePublic.org for all the details, or stop by a service plaza on the Maine Turnpike and pick up your Summer Breeze location finder.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We are learning about the prevalence of psychostimulant drug use in Maine and what can be done to help. Joining us, Becky Ireland with UNE and Dr. Ron Springle with Maine Recovery Residences. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email if you're quick to talk at mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post on our Facebook page. I'm going to start here with a question that came in as a tweet. This person asks, as a person diagnosed with ADHD later in life, I have seen a profound benefit from stimulant medication. It is already hard for folks with ADHD who legitimately need medication to get access to it, as a Schedule II drug, refills, and access to professionals who can and will prescribe is limited. I think it's important that the other side of this issue, the people who these drugs actually help, is just as important to understand as the risks. And Dr. Springle, there are millions of young people and adults alike who are on a medication for ADHD.
Yes, and the benefits are clear. When there's a proper diagnosis, a prescriber who is knowledgeable about the disorder that's being treated and proper monitoring, there's no reason why individuals can't benefit from these pharmaceutical medications. That's what they were invented for in the first place in most cases. The problems come into when there's overprescribing or misprescribing. without a proper diagnosis. And then when there's lack of medication security or education around the dangers that can exist, you can have ADHD and be prescribed Adderall and become dependent and begin to misuse these medications. I mean, that does happen, but if we're on the alert for that, then that can be addressed and the person continue to receive proper treatment.
So somebody who's listening to this program and has a child who is taking Adderall really need not panic, but really just pay attention.
Be aware of the dangers that could lurk, but like so many things in medicine, we have a risk benefit that we look at. What are the benefits of using these kind of medications versus the potential risk? And in most cases, the prescribers, I'm sure, have properly looked at that risk benefit and decided that the benefit outweighs the risk.
We'll go to Rita, who's calling from Hamden. Hi, Rita. Go ahead.
Good morning. I am the director for Wellsprings, New Horizons Detox Unit. And I simply wanted to say there's hope. Our unit, we have seen a significant increase in clients presenting with methamphetamine and the other psychostimulant drugs. They come here voluntarily. They're showing us a great deal of courage in that decision. And our program works with them through short-term detox as well as discharge planning for next steps for them. And there is hope, there is treatment. And we just wanted to make sure that as we're talking about all of this for those clients who find themselves in need of taking the next step in their recovery, there's hope and there are programs out there that can help them.
Well, Rita, thank you so much for calling in. And Dr. Springle, you're nodding, so I know that you find that message very important. I do want to ask, though, you know, we've learned a lot about opioids over the past decade or so, unfortunately, but we know that there are treatments for it. We think of Suboxone and things like that. Is there something like that when we're talking about stimulant, recovering from stimulant use?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Jennifer, and thanks for asking. Unfortunately, the answer is no. We don't have anything like that for psychostimulant use disorder. I mean, we have antabuse for alcoholism, which has its own detractors, but certainly has some benefit. We have Suboxone, buprenorphine, which is known as. We've had methadone since the 1960s. These are opiate replacement therapy types of medications that reduce craving, give people the opportunity for a stable life, and are not necessarily kind of lifelong supports. The vast majority of people using those medicines do eventually taper off. But for the psychostimulants, we don't have anything like that. We have a psychological treatment type of modalities. One is called contingency management, which is actually an app on your phone or something similar, which rewards certain changes in behavior with a small reward. It could be a small amount of money or it could be a gift or something beneficial to a person in early recovery from this. These have been shown to be effective, but the overall effective rates are not that great for anything. So we've got a long way to go. There are medicines. Modafinil is one which is being used now. It's actually used for other medical purposes. It's been approved medicine. Trying to find if that can narrow the gap in psychostimulant treatment disorder, but the results for that have not been that promising. There's a lot of research going on, but nothing really to be that excited about.
All right. We'll go to Michael, who's calling from Garland. Michael, we have lots of calls coming in, so we're going to ask everybody to be quick. Go ahead.
Good morning. So I was prescribed Concerta for many years, but that stopped in my 60s. Since then, and it was helpful. Since then, I've the last few years been taking a cup of coffee, caffeine, and with a few drops of THC-rich tincture in the coffee. And I wonder if I find that seems to level me out and help with my attention in sort of a similar way, maybe leveling my mood in the similar way that prescribed medications have in the past. But I don't have any medical supervision for this, and I wonder if you could recommend where I appreciated Dr. Davis being on your call, and I'll find him, email him. But do you have any ideas of where I might find medical supervision so that I could know about, be more aware of long-term usage effects?
Okay, Michael, I really appreciate your call. Our experts today are on addiction and recovery, but Dr. Springle, is there anything you'd like to say to Michael?
Well, it sounds like you had appropriate treatment for ADHD with Concerta. As people age, their physiology changes, brain chemistry can change, and the need for that can vary. It sounds like you've sort of developed your own sort of, call it like do-it-yourself through nutrition and diet. I don't have a specific recommendation, except you know, we find that naturopaths sometimes through, you know, can offer information about non-prescription medicines and therapy through food that could be beneficial.
All right. Good luck to you, Michael. We're going to turn to John, who's calling from Harpswell. John, if you could be quick, that would be great.
Absolutely. I myself am in long-term opioid recovery, thank goodness. And because of it, I actually started a business in the behavioral health space, which provided me lots of recovery capital and resources. My wife, recently, her brother had been long-term prescribed to high doses of Adderall, and he started towards the more recent years displaying some mental health issues. Our family ended up checking him into several different mental and behavioral health facilities involuntarily, and because he was an adult, he was able to always check himself out. And this was with me using my resources that I had cultivated working in the space. And even still, because he was an adult, he was always able to get himself out. And as of a few months ago, he committed suicide.
Oh.
And we have been left feeling like there's something that we couldn't do, and you know, or that we should have done that we didn't. And at the end of the day, I have to, you know, express my feeling towards the rest of the family that we really did do everything that we could have done. And that just the way that the laws are set up, because he was an adult, he had the ultimate power. And is there really any way that, I mean, this can change? I mean, is there any sort of adoption of a new way of doing things that might be a way out of this? I mean, I just feel like...
John, this is a really big question. A really big question, really big conversation. I know that people in the legislature and all sorts of people in the recovery community have struggled with this. Dr. Springle, is this Becky Ireland? Either of you, go ahead. Dr. Springle?
Thanks, Jennifer. And John, I'm so sorry to hear of the loss of your loved one. You know, Maine does not have restrictive laws around adults. For example, in Massachusetts, there's a section, we call it being section, where adults can be held against their will for a period of time. Other states, Kentucky's another example that has developed laws from a grassroots effort from people that have lost loved ones, just the way you have, that have developed a movement, developed the political capital and will. And we don't have that right now in the state of Maine. It's not a criticism, it's just the way that things are. I don't know of any other New England state except Massachusetts actually have that. What we recommend is for the families themselves to get the kind of education and get the information that they need from programs such as Al-Anon Family Groups, Nar-Anon, and also in Maine, we have a group called the Family Restored, which is not a 12-step program, but a free program for families that are dealing with loved ones that have these kinds of issues. Thefamilyrestored.org is the website, just the way it sounds. They have meetings all over the region and other states as well, and they do a terrific job in helping families to cope.
John, I'm so sorry to hear about your brother. Thanks for calling in. We're going to go to Grayson Luckner, who's calling in, a state representative. Hi, Grayson, go ahead. And again, if you could be quick, we're really tight on time. Thanks.
Sure thing. Thanks for squeezing me in. We often hear in the Criminal Justice Committee this last session about the need for law enforcement to continue having sort of a punitive approach to folks with substance use disorder, and that, you know, them saying that it's affected, I think, people in the treatment and recovery. It would seem that we have the clinicians and the doctors on one side.
So, Grayson, your phone connection isn't great. Is what you're asking is what kind of data there is on how effective law enforcement is in getting people into treatment and getting them the help they need?
Exactly right. Yeah.
Okay. Great. Great. Dr. Springle.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Sorry to keep going to you. Becky's expertise
is
prevention.
So if we look around the main landscape, both in the Department of Corrections and then in the county jail systems, we find very, very large numbers of individuals who are incarcerated that can be diagnosed with a substance use disorder of one type or another. Fortunately, in Maine, through Commissioner Randy Liberty and Dr. Ryan Thornell, the assistant deputy, they've made very strong positive steps in the last few years that have, for example, made medication-assisted therapy, medication for opioid use disorder, available in jails and in prisons, and especially when people are getting ready to come back into the community. That we believe is reducing the relapse rate. But jails are not treatment centers. We find drug courts are expanding, and that is keeping a lot of people, out from behind bars and giving them the opportunity to actually get treatment. So I think we're going to see more of this. The legislature has moved to increase these programs in the last session, and we have to just keep asking for more.
All right. Grayson, thank you for your call. We'll go to Ethan in Saco. Ethan, if you can be about 20 seconds, that'd be great.
Oh, my gosh. All right, I'll cut it short. So we're all addicted to something, whether it's coffee or sugar or whatever, Coca-Cola, Mountain Dew. But it's our education system that's pushing the boys to they want to act out and stuff. So instead of guiding with or working with them, we're giving them Adderall and stuff. But the other thing is, if we decriminalize all these drugs, a lot of this stuff goes away. We can get a tax revenue off of it, and we're taking away the stigma in the black market. Thank you very much.
Oh, boy, that's an idea for a whole show. But, Becky, what's your instinctive response, a 10-second response to the idea of decriminalizing drugs?
Just that law enforcement partners know we're not going to enforce our way out of this. They have been excellent partners in prevention. They work with our communities and our schools and our parents to try to figure out so that we aren't looking to enforcement to solve this, and that it's more about looking why people are using the substances and giving them the support, the care, and the skills they need so that substances don't become the answer to their struggles and stressors in life.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. I have a note here that the state is starting a stimulant prevention campaign in August, and that there is a methamphetamine prevention task force that meets to address this. So we will, of course, be following up on this topic, so important. And thank you both so much for being here on Maine Calling. You just heard from Becky Ireland. She is with the UNE, the Center for Excellence in Health Innovation, and Dr. Ronald Springle at the Maine Association of Recovery Residences. Maine Calling, produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. This is Maine Public Radio.